Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the School of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today, I have a good friend of mine on, Marcelo Lima. He is the founder and portfolio manager at Heller House, which he started in 2010. Marcelo, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you on.
Hey, Eric, thanks for having me. It's a huge pleasure, and it's my honor.
Oh, right on. And for you guys out there, I've wanted Marcelo to come on for a while. So I'm glad you finally took the plunge there.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, is this your first podcast that you've ever done, or?
Yeah, it is. Oh, cool.
I was telling another guest maybe a couple of months ago it was also his first podcast, and I said, I hope I don't scare you off from doing a future podcast. So same goes for you. I hope I can get you back for a few more after this.
Oh, I hope it's worth it. Thank you.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about Amazon today, and I thought that would make for an interesting episode. And why I specifically wanted to bring you on is I feel like you have intelligent things to say about Amazon. Everyone kind of knows it's a great company, and there's a great CEO, and they're a disruptor, and they're innovative. But usually when I hear people's analysis, it's like, well, they're a great company, so go buy the stock, and then they're a disruptor and they're innovative. And it's like, oh, okay, like that wasn't very convincing. So I'd love to hear just more of your more in-depth view on Amazon, how you look at Amazon, how you kind of came to Amazon as a value guy. I think it's very interesting, and I'll ask you questions if any come to mind. So tell me a little bit about your take on Amazon.
Well, Eric, first I have to disqualify myself. I don't think I'm any sort of expert. If I have any, let's say, comparative advantages, it's in synthesizing what others have done. Mm-hmm. So I'm truly standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, Amazon has been.
By the way, Marcelo, there's a lot of wisdom in being able to synthesize a lot of big picture principles. No, not everyone can do that. So.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah, so it's a different kind of skill set, and something that I do find common in the value investing world, personally.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, I guess that's
common.
True.
More common.
Yeah. So you know, I've really relied on the analysis of a lot of other people in terms of just getting comfortable with the idea, because as a this is me coming off of a big transition period where I traditionally have been much more of a Ben Graham type of investor, and recently have evolved into this mentality that there are different ways of looking at the world, and perhaps I do have some blind spots that I have to take care of, and Amazon was one of the first businesses that I started analyzing in depth, and then I sort of approach it as, you know, from first principles. I want to figure it out by myself. You know, I don't want to rely on other people's analysis, and so I other people's analysis brought me into the story, but then I sort of wanted to verify everything on my own.
Right. So what was sort of the initial Amazon's worth looking at it? Was it just that it's a great quality company and you want to learn more about great quality companies, or was there something else that said, oh, I really need to look at Amazon?
Well, it was this realization that, quote unquote, and this is a very overused phrase, everything is getting disrupted. Mm-hmm. I remember watching this demonstration of Amazon's Alexa, where you could say, "Hey, Amazon, order batteries," or "Alexa, order batteries," and Alexa would say, "Hey, you know, I found Amazon Basics. This is the price. Would you like it?" And you would say, "No." Well, and Alexa would say, "That's the only brand I have." And that was a huge wake-up call for the brand owners. And I remember having a conversation with the CEO of a large CPG company, and he said, "Look, I'm actually much more worried about the move to a voice-first interface than I am, a move to e-commerce."
That's interesting, because I'm, as a consumer, just purely speaking from the consumer, I'm at a point where I find, like, my parents have Alexa. I find her obnoxious. Like, I tell my mom, I'm like, you know, what you just did with Alexa, I could have just done manually faster.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, you know, and to be fair, the numbers out there that we've seen, and this is not from Amazon, this is from third parties,
right,
is that shopping is really not the top use case at all. In fact, very few people have used it to shop.
What's the top use case for Alexa?
Apparently, it's listening to music and listening to news.
Okay. I feel like just my gut, without being able to predict the future here, I have a feeling that probably won't be how it is forever, though, right? As things get more advanced, would you say so?
I agree with you. I think that this idea of ambient computing, where it's sort of everywhere and it's all pervasive and it's invisible, is something that will increasingly happen. In fact, you know, that was one of the topics off the Oculus conference last week, and we can talk about that later. But definitely think that that's a trend. In fact, you know, Alexa is going everywhere. As you know, it's sort of a horizontal strategy where they want to have them in hotels and cars.
You know, one day there will be, this is my prediction, I'm sure I'm not the first one to make this prediction, I was thinking about this the other day, there will be an Alexa kitchen where everything in the kitchen is automated.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
And you have a robot that just makes you your food at the perfect temperature, perfect sear, everything perfect.
Yeah, that's you know, there's
Alexa,
some ovens.
I'm hungry. What do you recommend for steaks tonight? What cows are in season? Like, you know, just shit like that, and they order things like magically in your refrigerator through a chute, and it just preps you your ingredients and food. I feel like that's the future.
Yeah, the pieces of the puzzle are there, right? So Amazon has a technology for Alexa. It owns Whole Foods. There's a number of interesting oven technologies out there, like Tovala and some others, where it practically automates cooking. So yeah,
Alexa, drive me to Miami to have this conversation in person right now. You have a self-driving car that just pulls up and chauffeurs you over.
That's right.
Interesting. So anyway, I don't want to get too off topic, but it's fun to think about this shit. So when you're looking at Amazon as not just a great business, but as a great investment or a potential good investment, what are you looking at? And you were talking about that conference as well, and I didn't want to skip over that.
Right. So at first, my initial approach was trying to just figure out, you know, this company is disrupting a lot of different sectors of the economy. Let me try to figure them out. You know, don't they, you know, the joke was that Amazon was a charitable organization run by members of, you know, the investment community to sort of just give people free stuff, right? That was sort of the joke on Amazon. Yeah. And so this lack of profitability was touted by the media all the time. Look, Amazon doesn't make money. Where in reality, if you looked under the hood, it turned out that Amazon was creating enormous amounts of cash flow, that it was investing aggressively. And if you understood Jeff Bezos's his strategy to reinvest all those cash flows in experiments and fulfillment centers and all the R&D and other initiatives that Amazon was fueling, then you could sort of back into a valuation that made sense, assuming a future state of the world in terms of normalized margins, et cetera. And then you could look at comps like, you know, Walmart. You know, at a certain scale, Amazon would have a certain level of profitability, and then at what multiple would it trade at, et cetera. So once you started realizing that, you could then start looking at Amazon as a potential investment that actually made sense.
So can you walk me through the numbers of like actually what you were looking at and what you were seeing in the future?
Sure. So, you know, with something like Amazon, it makes sense and I guess we have to talk about this idea of a technology adoption curve, because I really can't get away from that in this topic, in this discussion. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where are we right now in terms of e-commerce adoption? You know, if you look at the census numbers for retail sales and for e-commerce, Amazon is roughly 50% of e-commerce, and overall, it's about, you know, e-commerce is about 13% of U.S. retail sales. So maybe Amazon is 6.5% of total U.S. retail sales, and then you have to assume a certain rate of growth of retail sales over time, and sort of what Amazon can capture incrementally of that over the years. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, is there going to be more e-commerce in 10 or 20 years or less? And I think the answer is more. It's like Jeff Bezos, right? Ask what's not going to change, right? Are people going to want lower prices or higher prices, more convenience or less convenience? So that's how he thinks. So you can bet that that's what he wants to deliver to the consumer, because after all, this is a very consumer-centric business. So once you realize that, okay, maybe, you know, we are in this massive adoption curve of e-commerce, and we now live in a mobile first world where people are increasingly shopping on their smartphones. And so a lot of these assumptions of the old world, where I'm going to get into a car, I'm going to drive to a big box, stand in line, etc., a lot of these assumptions are, I think, perhaps true for an older generation, but I think the newer generation will turn to e-commerce with much more enthusiasm. So once you can underwrite growth for Amazon, then you say, okay, well, what's a reasonable growth rate? What's the total addressable market of retail sales? And what can normalized margins look like? And so this is just sort of the core retail business. And of course, I'm not even talking about the marketplace business, which has much higher margins and versus the inventory that they hold on to, that they procure, sort of the 1P versus 3P platform. So that's sort of the valuation just for the core retail part.
Okay. And then what about for the other parts of the business?
Right. So Amazon, of course, the other big business that they have is Amazon Web Services. And what astonished me about Amazon Web Services is, of course, at first I had no idea what cloud computing was, and I had to go figure it out. And once I realized So I went to Vegas and I went to the Amazon Web Services conference and to see it firsthand, and it was just absolutely astonishing to me. So once you hear enough executives talking about this, you hear the folks from Airbnb, Siemens, Netflix, Sony, Viacom, NASA, et cetera, give presentations as to, you know, here's why I moved to AWS. Here's why my operating expenses are down and sort of my CapEx is down. This is now turned CapEx to OpEx, and my services are much better. They're much faster. My database calls are I can scale at a much faster pace than before with much lower cost. It just becomes an absolute no-brainer to move to AWS. Mm-hmm. Once I understood that, and I saw 40,000 developers at the conference and all the companies that were there, then I really understood the power of this and sort of what it meant to be a cloud computing business. And so you start to see the future a little bit, right? And then you look at the industry. You look at, well, what are the other big players? You have Microsoft Azure, you have Google Cloud Platform. What are those companies doing? Is there product market fit there? Is there adoption of – and there is massive adoption of those cloud infrastructure companies as well. So then you look, okay, what's the total addressable market? And once you realize the size of the market and where we are now, then it just becomes absolutely clear that AWS could be a much larger business in the future than it is today.
And what kind of numbers are you looking at?
So this is as of sort of the middle of this year. So AWS run rate revenues are about $24 billion. Mm-hmm. Google Cloud Platform. So that's – we know AWS because they break it out. And for Google and Azure, this is sort of a guesstimate based on public statements. We don't really know because they don't really break out their public cloud revenues.
But is Amazon the only one that breaks it out?
Yep.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, so Amazon, we know it's about $24 billion run rate. So if you annualize their Q2 revenues. Google Cloud is about $5 billion per year, and Azure is about $10 billion. So total cloud, let's call it $39 billion. I'm ignoring some of the really smaller players like Oracle and Salesforce. Mm-hmm. Because they're sort of rounding errors and they're sort of playing in a little bit different type. It's not the sort of infrastructure as a service as these companies are. So call it $40 billion of run rate revenues. And, you know, what's the TAM? What's the total addressable market? We don't really know. If you ask Goldman Sachs, I think their latest estimate is something like just over $600 billion. If you ask the people in the cloud industry, like Diane Greene, the CEO of Google Cloud, or Andy Jassy, CEO of AWS, it's more like $1 trillion or maybe multi-trillion dollars. Of course, they have an incentive to make that number really big.
Right.
But let's assume it's $1 trillion. Then we're 4% of the way there. You know, so we're at the very beginning of this adoption
curve. Right. So how are you valuing these segments of Amazon?
So once you have the valuation for the core retail business, and then perhaps you split that into two, you have the 1P and the 3P, and you sort of value the marketplace a little bit different with different margins.
What do you mean by 1P and 3P for listeners out there?
Yeah, so there's the inventory. There are the products that Amazon sources from manufacturers and sells itself. And then they have the whole marketplace business where they simply act as a middleman and they take a cut of the sale. And they provide services like advertising and fulfillment and shipping and logistics and all that. So those businesses have different margin structures, and you can assume different types of margins for both of those. And again, we don't know exactly what the split is. We know more or less that maybe half the volumes sold on Amazon today are marketplace. So it's just a matchmaking business where they earn much higher margins than on just regular retail.
Yeah. So, I mean, you must be using those some specific numbers or a range of numbers, right? I mean, because you're coming up with some, you know, intrinsic value for these business segments, correct?
Yeah, look, it's always a moving target because there are always new things happening. And what I'll tell you is here's sort of what I think is a good way to look at it.
Okay.
If you
could just use specific numbers if possible, which it just makes it a little bit more real.
Right. So if you let's just take the cloud business, Amazon Web Services, $24 billion of run rate revenues. Mm-hmm. And they're growing like 45, 46% year over year. You have to assume that that's going to go down over time, that growth rate.
Sure.
So let's assume that that fades to, you know, low 30s. And, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but let's say it fades into the low 30s over the next 7 years. You would still
I think for anyone who knows even just a little bit about this industry, that does not sound that crazy at all.
Yeah. So I'll see, you know, I'll show you where we end up, and I don't think this is an insane assumption, but you end up with about $240 billion of revenues for AWS. Mm-hmm. And if you add up all the cloud providers, again, taking their growth rate and moving it down, you end up with about $470 billion of revenues. If you assume that the total addressable market grows like 5% a year, mm-hmm. then those revenues are about 34% of the total addressable market in 2025. Again, this is super back of the envelope.
Sure.
Like, this is, who knows? I can guarantee you that these numbers are wrong. I just don't know in which direction they're wrong.
Right.
But again, we're sort of guesstimating with a little bit of an educated guess here.
That's why I said you'll have a range. I mean, you have five people who do the same exercise, you'll have five different numbers.
That's right. Right. And so you assume a certain multiple at that period of sort of either multiple of sales or multiple of EBIT, and you have to obviously assume a certain margin structure. We know today that AWS is about a 25% EBIT margin or operating margin. So the numbers I get are, and I think these are not aggressive numbers, but I don't think they're conservative either, but I think they're sort of realistic, is you get sort of a value for AWS 7 years from now that's about 2.4, it's going to sound ridiculous, but it's $2.4 trillion. It's like a 10 times multiple of revenues. Mm-hmm. If you discount that at 10% per year, you get a value for AWS today that's $1.4 trillion, and that's more than the entire enterprise value of Amazon today. So again, maybe, you know, if I'm off by 50%, right? So maybe AWS only has a present value of $500 billion. That's already, you know, more than half of Amazon's enterprise value today. So what value do you ascribe to their retail business and their emerging advertising business, et cetera? So I think that this is a way to triangulate into a reasoning that Amazon seems to be undervalued today.
And what numbers approximately? I know these are obviously going to be approximate numbers, but when you apply that same exercise to the retail segment, what do you come up with?
I don't have the retail segment modeled out in front of me right now. I had the cloud tab pulled up here because I knew we were going to talk about it.
Yep.
But the retail segment, what I did there is. And I don't have it in front of me, but what I did there is I assumed a certain growth rate, again fading, of course, and how big could this be, and do the numbers make sense, right? The numbers at the end of whatever forecast period have to make sense in terms of the total addressable market, right? You can't have a number that's bigger than retail sales in the U.S. And then of course Amazon has international sales as well, and they're aggressively investing in India. They're pretty big in Western Europe, in certain countries of Western Europe at least, and you know, what's a reasonable operating margin at that point? Is it 5%?
I was going to ask you, what do you think a reasonable operating margin would be at that end point?
I would think at least 5% for the retail business, perhaps a little bit higher, maybe as high as 8%. So that's been a topic of discussion in Amazon's conference calls, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think the executives had said at one point that it could be low double digits, but they've sort of backed away from that recently because they're investing a lot in growth. Mm-hmm. So we really don't know. This is a company that has an insatiable appetite for growth, and you know they'll keep reinvesting as long as it makes sense.
It's interesting. So why do you think? You know, I always wonder. So here's Amazon's a company that everyone knows of. That is in every index fund, a lot of the major ETFs, right? To the point that people are even forced to buy it if it's because of the inclusion on the index and it's so big. Why do you think this opportunity exists? I mean, I have my personal view, but I want to know what your view is.
You know, I think things are priced in general to assume a lot of risks and assume a lot of uncertainties. I'm not of the view that things are priced to perfection at every point in time. In fact, you know, let me just bring something up that I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a paper by Jeremy Siegel talking about the Nifty 50s, and you know these were sort of the most fashionable stocks of the late 60s and early 70s. And what's interesting about this paper is, you know, a lot of investors got burned buying these companies, buying these stocks in the early 70s. And then there was this massive oil price spike and recession, and the stock prices fell 70, 80%, and people lost a lot of money. What's interesting about this Jeremy Siegel paper is that if you had bought an equally weighted basket of these very popular stocks and held on to them for a very long period of time, I think it's something like 26 years or something like that, you would have essentially matched the return of the S&P 500. So even though these companies and the companies back then were something like, you know, Xerox and Kodak and General Motors, yep, a lot of these were trading at very high multiples, like 40, 50, 60 times earnings. And despite that, the growth rate of the earnings was high enough to justify attractive sort of an S&P matching return over more than two decades. So I'm not certain that markets adequately price in, you know, even sort of obvious growth.
Right. Interesting. There's also that other you can just take a list of every large company in the S&P and track, you know, what their price is, you know, from top tick to bottom tick, you know, from their high and low every year. And the range is pretty high, and you know intrinsic value has not changed that much in a given year.
There's that. I absolutely agree. And I've seen that exercise done, and I've run the numbers myself, and it's astonishing.
Pretty staggering,
right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, when I started trying to understand the cloud business, I realized that there wasn't really anybody I could talk to that understood this super well, and I'm sure there's a lot of really smart people out there who get it, but I don't know if that if that set of people who understand it overlaps with the general population. Mm-hmm. So, and the people sort of buying the stock at the margins. My guess is it doesn't overlap. My guess is there's a small number of specialists and people who work in the industry. You know, I had the pleasure of speaking with a Google cloud engineer recently who's known about this for many, many, many years. But he's of course an industry insider and he understands the business well. So there's a lot of sort of, you know, Jeff Bezos has said many times, we are very much willing to be misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And there's been this constant narrative that Amazon doesn't generate any profits and that it's a bubble, et cetera. So perhaps that also plays into it.
I think another thing, I'm going to add just one more thing that plays into it, is this is not the first time I've had this experience where you're experiencing two different communities that not only don't overlap, but they often actually will be at odds with each other. So for instance, I saw a very interesting thing on LinkedIn today. I think it was today, maybe yesterday. And it was Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V for short, doing a thing on two stocks that he likes for like the long run. Right now, this is a guy who's like a venture, you know, does a lot of like venture capital and angel investing work, and you know, he understands Facebook and Amazon, especially Facebook, probably better than almost any normal person ever would. Because his whole thing is understanding advertising and networking and how social systems work. He gets that shit. But there wasn't one mention of valuation in his whole spiel. And I have found that the people that I've met in my life that who understand cloud, who get excited about different kinds of technology, they're also more into like, you know, hanging out with like the Tesla people. And, you know, they're not even remotely interested in the value investing world. It just doesn't fit their personality. And then on the flip side, right, there's people in the value investing world where we're trained to be skeptical. We're trained to not take a CEO's word as the truth and to actually question him or her about everything and actually assume that they're being over generous with their assumptions, right? So people in our community have a much harder time getting excited about something, and typically the more boring something and more predictable something is, the more attracted we are to it, right? So it's two completely different default mentalities, and in a case like Amazon and what you're speaking about, the people who will know the most about the business are probably not people in the value investment community.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. And it reminds me of a podcast that I heard a while back with Mark Andreessen. And he said something like, you know, Warren Buffett is investing in Heinz Ketchup and he's making the bet that that'll never change. And I am making the exact opposite bet. I'm making the bet that the thing that I'm funding is going to disrupt that ketchup brand and will capture all the value. And of course, the scary part is capture all the value, right? So when I started hearing about disruption and seeing it, and then seeing a lot of traditional boring businesses that don't change, quote unquote, being disrupted, you have to start questioning your assumptions and whether your model of the world is an accurate model, right? And maybe bring your valuation tools to this world and try to understand it better.
Correct. You know, I've experienced this firsthand, where I had this idea for a totally different way to do shareholder activism, as an example, right? Have all the data, have all the studies, everything. Not one person in the value investing community gave a shit. Not one. Because it's the same principle. I was trying to take two communities that have completely different mindsets, and you know, people didn't get it. And then when I try to talk to the other community that's already doing this stuff, but you know, as consultants or coaches and not as value investors, they didn't really see the point of starting a fund. Even though I'm like, you can make $1 billion with your skill set, and they're like, oh, okay, well, that's like gambling. I'd just rather just stick to what I know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I got the same resistance on the other side as well, who didn't get the value investing piece.
Yeah, we all have to work against our blind spots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, work against our blind spots and being open to like the awareness that there are other worlds, other ways of point of views, other lenses of looking at reality that are different from ours. And then while I would say the value investing lens and the principles like margin of safety, intrinsic value, all the Ben Graham stuff, like those are clearly very useful principles. If that's everything that you got and you're unwilling to look beyond that, you could limit yourself and actually not see certain opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I have exactly what you said sort of imprinted in my head now, you know, especially, and I think maybe this is a good segue. You know, Ben Graham is known for all of these teachings, margin of safety and all of these ideas. And the irony, what I find incredibly ironic, and this is, again, this is a blind spot on my end, is that if Ben Graham, the majority of his track record is attributable to one stock only, and that's Geico. And that was never a cigar butt or something with a huge margin of safety in the traditional Ben Graham sense. Right.
Yeah, very interesting. In regards to Amazon, is there anything else that you think is worth sharing about or worth mentioning?
Well, I think it's one thing that excites me about Amazon is thinking about what the total addressable market is. So, you know, so there's retail, and then there is this marketplace business, and then there's logistics. So now there's advertising, and Amazon already has something like $6 to $7 billion of run rate advertising revenues, and it's growing very fast. And some estimates put that at 10 or 11 billion by the end of the year. Who knows what it is? Because again, they don't break it out. But it, right. we know it was about, you know, $2.5 billion in Q2. And then there is potentially they're attacking the TV market and. There's a bunch of other, you know, they own Twitch, so gaming, video streaming, and how far does it go, right? Amazon just invested in a manufactured housing operation, and if you look at Sears, you know, Sears and Roebuck was an incredibly rich conglomerate. They they created Allstate Insurance. They created
is that right? Did they spin off Allstate from Sears?
Yeah,
I did not know that. That's interesting.
According to Wikipedia,
huh.
So they also had a financial services business and all these phenomenal brands that they developed in house, and Teen Magazine, which was licensed from their sort of teen clothing brand. So there's a lot of interesting things that are still, I think, to come. You know, Amazon has these incredible pillars, right? AWS, Marketplace, and Prime. And what can it layer on top of this once it owns – because now it owns this trusted customer relationship. And I think that there is a lot left to be done.
Amazon Pharmacy.
Right. That's another one. Right? They just acquired PillPack. Absolutely.
You could imagine too that they would potentially be trying to deregulate some of the healthcare industry to say, oh, hey, you know, you want your prescription. Just get it through us.
Right, so they partnered with Berkshire Hathaway and Chase on that. So
it'll be interesting to see what they do. I do you have any insight to what they're gonna do?
Zero.
Yeah,
I'm just glad that they're doing it, and they seem to have hired a very thoughtful guy. Right, Atul Gawande couldn't ask for a better guy.
Yeah. Have you thought about Alexa as well in terms of ways they could? I mean, do you see Alexa as like a future tool, like for like an additional business, or do you see it more supporting the other businesses?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I was at a conference recently, and there was I can't remember which executive from Amazon was there, but I think it was the executive in charge of Alexa, and I can't remember his or her name, so I apologize, but. They split the business in two. So there's the consumer Alexa and the enterprise Alexa. Okay. And the enterprise Alexa is under AWS. So Alexa for business. And that one, I think, is it could be a very, very viable business because you have very, very real business use cases that businesses are willing to pay for.
I guess, but so that was interesting. I wasn't even, so I wasn't actually talking specifically about, I was thinking more of like, let's say you develop a product, right? And you want it to have Alexa accessibility as an example, right? Is that, do you think that's a market where you can pay like a licensing fee and, you know, you can then use Alexa with your product? Or do you think that just kind of stays all in-house and Alexa doesn't do something like that?
I think that the strategy is to have Alexa everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's for strategic reasons that you want to be everywhere because you displace your competitors. You also want to be everywhere because you gather the most data and that improves your product at a faster speed.
Well, I guess where I'm going is like, let's say what kind of computer do you have? If you don't mind me asking.
Well, I have a PC, a laptop, an iPad.
What's the company that makes your laptop?
I have a ThinkPad.
Okay. So is that IBM?
Well, it's Lenovo, right?
Lenovo,
and,
okay.
and by the way, it has Alexa. What is it? It actually has those far field microphones built in. So it has Alexa and Cortana built in.
Okay. So like if you were going to say like, you know, Alexa, turn on my computer, turn on my laptop or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or open up my laptop and turn it on and whatever it is in the future. Does Lenovo have to pay some kind of license to be able to have Alexa on their product, or does Alexa just kind of give that out to any product that wants to have it used? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I think that the right now they're not monetizing that particular use case. I think the use case that they will be monetizing is perhaps more industrial applications. That's more of a consumer application. Right, mm-hmm. Because I'm the consumer using
the
laptop.
Sure.
But I think in more enterprise settings, or perhaps let's say I don't know what their commercial agreement is, but there is Alexa now in a lot of new Lennar houses. They have sort of Echo devices with Alexa in them, and okay. I don't know if Amazon. I read a news article that says that Amazon is getting paid by Lennar for the privilege of having Lennar install the Echo devices.
That's the same concept we're talking about. For Lenovo
yes.
to have the privilege to install Alexa onto their laptops, you know, for Apple to have it, you know, implemented into their operating system, Alexa gives them certain source code, but Apple has to pay for it. That's what I'm getting at is could you see that happening, or does that get in the way? And actually Amazon just goes, hey, you know, any product that wants to use us, please do, because it only helps Amazon in some way. I don't know. It's just something I was just thinking about off the top of my head right now as we're talking.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And
this
I
is
bet
why
you
I don't plan my questions, because I'll think of shit that would just not be on the script otherwise.
No, I think it's a great question, and it's probably one that's debated a lot internally at Amazon. I don't have a great answer, but I think you're onto something.
Yeah, interesting. All right, Marcelo, any last words around Amazon, or you think we covered the gist of it?
Well, I think that's it. You know, I just it's exciting to see what else they're going to do, and I'm sure if we were to talk again in a year, we'd have a completely different conversation, because who knows in what other businesses they're going to be in, right?
Well, maybe we can do that.
For sure.
All right, Marcelo, it was a pleasure having you on. Have a great rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.